From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yesterday, the appeal was upheld, and we will provide coverage for the procedure.
Cigna is forced to reverse its decision and cover a bone marrow transplant for Thomas Kincannon.
Tom will be headed to Boston next week to get his treatment, and we're all very, very happy.
We'll give you the latest on the legal aid attorney's case, but then look at the tens of millions of people in this country who are uninsured. Then, from the coffers of Congress to the hands of coup leaders, the money trail that ties the U.S. to the attempted coup in Venezuela. And finally, has fascism returned to Europe? We'll look at the rise of French ultranationalist Jean-Marie Le Pen and the recent rash of anti-Jewish violence there. Coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Covert U.S. military teams have been quietly participating in attacks in Pakistan in recent weeks, they say, on suspected al-Qaeda hideouts. Pakistani security officials say the U.S. forces are operating with Pakistani troops and the Pakistanis are doing the bulk of the work. They say they intend to try and keep the mission quiet to avoid political unrest. The Washington Post is reporting the operation was also being kept secret because of nervousness among Pakistani officials about a referendum next week. The referendum would extend General Pervez Musharraf's presidency for 5 years, circumventing the electoral process. Musharraf took power in a coup 3 years ago. Meanwhile, he vowed to promote Islamic democracy if people vote for him. His comments came as some 500 Pakistani lawyers boycotted court proceedings across the country in a strike to protest the referendum. The European Union slammed racism, xenophobia, and anti-Semitism in response to attacks on Jewish sites in Europe. A spate of attacks from anti-Jewish graffiti to assaults on synagogues and schools broke out after Israel attacked the Palestinian territories in March. The London Independent is reporting there's been a sevenfold increase in attacks on Jews in Britain in the past 2 months. Leaders of the Jewish community believe the increase is linked to the Israeli crackdown on the West Bank. Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah urged President Bush Thursday to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in two West Bank towns, in part to restore U.S. credibility in the Arab world. The two met at his ranch in Texas. Bush told reporters Abdullah said he would not use oil as a weapon against the U.S. The United Nations met Thursday with Israeli officials seeking to change the composition and limit the scope of a team which will investigate the Israeli army's attack on the Jenin refugee camp. UN complied with one of Israel's demands and added two military officers to the team. The UN insisted the team will arrive in the Middle East on Saturday as planned. Nine Palestinian teenagers left the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem yesterday. They brought with them two bodies, which have been decomposing inside the church for days. The London Independent reports the Israeli army threw smoke bombs to obscure the event from the world's TV cameras. Israeli officers allowed only one reporter to meet the teenagers, Fox TV's talk show host Geraldo Rivera. Fox TV has close links to Ariel Sharon. Israeli forces raided the West Bank city of Qalqilya today, despite a fresh call from President Bush for Israel to complete the withdrawal. Elsewhere, Israeli troops killed at least six Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. The University of California, Berkeley, has suspended from campus students who are calling for the university to divest from companies who support Israel. The students took over a building to launch the South Africa-style divestment campaign earlier this month. Administrators say 41 students will be suspended for up to a year under a crackdown on academic disruptions. The action means the group is barred from holding demonstrations on campus, having an information table, or even handing out leaflets. The European Union's parliament on Thursday slammed the U.S. use of military tribunals to try Taliban and al-Qaeda prisoners being held on Guantanamo Bay and called on the U.S. to respect the Geneva Conventions. The parliament passed a human rights report that singled out the U.S. for violating the rights of prisoners captured in Afghanistan during the U.S.-led war there. The human rights report also says terrorism can be used as a pretext for governments to violate human rights, silence critics, or eliminate opposition. And the Senate has overwhelmingly approved an energy bill designed by Democratic leaders as an alternative to the Bush plan. The bill includes $14 billion in tax cuts, which sponsors claim are evenly divided between production and incentives to encourage conservation and development of alternative energy sources. But environmentalists denounce the bill, calling it a missed opportunity, despite increasing criticism of how U.S. dependence on Mideast oil dictates U.S. foreign policy. Lawmakers scrapped even the most modest steps to improve automobile fuel efficiency from the bill.
Oh, where are you going, said the man at his desk. I'm going to a new world, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twill well that he stood. I'm going to a new world, said the child, and he stood. Oh, I'm sounding drums of war, said the man at his desk. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man at his desk. Yes, I do, but you don't, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. Yes, I do, but you don't, said the child, and he stood. Oh, but do you know the truth, said the man at his desk. Yes, you lie and call it truth, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. You lie and call it truth, said the child, and he stood. Well, you must be scared to die, said the man at his desk. No, I'm prepared, and you're scared, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I'm prepared, and you're scared, said the child, and he stood. Well, I think I hear the bell, said a man at his desk. Yes, it's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. Yes, it's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood. Yes, it's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood.
Stefan Smith singing The Bell here in our Firehouse studio. Thank you, Stefan. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country.
Well, Juan, I'm taking a look at the New York Observer of this week, and it seems that they got a hold of a memo that you wrote to the New York Daily News about their, what you're calling, anti-Palestinian coverage that's been filling, quote, our newspaper every day for the past 2 weeks. Can you talk about it?
Well, I meant it as an internal memo to the management, but apparently it's gotten out. But it was basically a long list of criticisms of our coverage of the Middle East situation now, and I submitted it to the management on April 10th, and I'm still waiting for a response. I think the coverage got even worse after the memo than it was before. But amazingly, I was surprised to see how many reporters at the newspaper came up to me afterwards and said, do you want us to sign a petition? Because we also are upset. But I told them, no, I wasn't trying to make it into a pitched open battle, but I did want to let the management know that some of us at the newspaper really do have major concerns about the bias in the coverage.
Well, you have a publisher, Mort Zuckerman, who is a major spokesperson, I won't even say for Israel, but for Ariel Sharon, the prime minister. And a lot of the guests that we've had on our program and talking about the what they call Sharon rally, the pro-Sharon rally, as opposed to pro-Israel. And these are Jewish guests and rabbis that we've had on the program. He was one of the major speakers and owns your paper.
Yeah, well, I think it has to have some kind of an impact on the management of the paper to know that our owner is playing such an open and politically involved role in the current situation. And seeing him on a variety of talk shows must have an impact on the editors when they're making coverage decisions.
Well, we're going to turn first to a major victory for people who heard about Tom Kincannon and for Tom Kincannon's himself story. And Juan, you wrote about this in the New York Daily News. We did the piece on Wednesday here on Democracy Now!, the legal aid lawyer who heads up the Eastern District of New York Legal Aid Society Federal Defenders for the last 30 years, and his battle with his insurance company, Cigna, which is one of the most, one of the largest private insurers in this country. He went up to Boston, to New England Medical, to have a bone marrow transplant. His doctor said it was his only hope. He has multiple myeloma for the past 2 years. They'd even inserted the tubes in his chest to begin the transplant that he was going to get from the bone marrow from his sister. And then Cigna denied coverage of the operation, said it was the first time for a patient in his condition that an insurance company had denied that coverage. And we brought our listeners his story on Wednesday. That day, Cigna, which is based in Connecticut, got hundreds of calls throughout the day. And at that time, an external review organization called IPRO, which is Island Peer Review Organization, was hearing the appeal. His lawyer, another legal aid attorney, Elizabeth Benjamin, had brought the appeal to this outside agency. Well, Cigna got hundreds of calls, and yesterday, just after the program, where it came down that they have reversed Cigna's decision, and Tom Kincannon is now headed to Boston, to New England Medical, to continue with the operation. This is
one small victory in the battle for healthcare in this country.
That's right. This is what spokesperson for Cigna had to say yesterday evening. They won't speak on the record, but she was willing to record just this comment of Cigna Insurance. This is Gail Silver.
This is Gail Silver, Assistant Vice President in Public Affairs for Cigna Healthcare. We are committed to ensuring that our members have access to quality care, and we do provide coverage for bone marrow and stem cell transplants when the benefit of the treatment is supported by scientific evidence. For the procedure Mr. Kincannon currently seeks, we encouraged him to follow the full appeals process in New York, which includes an appeal to the insurance department and review by independent medical experts. Yesterday, the appeal was upheld, and we will provide coverage for the procedure.
That was Gail Silver of Cigna. Well, I went over at about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon over to the Federal Defenders Division in Brooklyn, New York, where a little party was being held for Tom Kincannon, the head of that division, who's now headed up to Boston. And he was standing with his legal aid attorney, Elizabeth Benjamin. But this is what Tom had to say.
Only in retrospect is it apparent how much strain went into each day with my wife and trying to explain to my daughter what was going on, and why was this delayed, and were we keeping something from her? Did this suggest bad news or that it wouldn't work at all? So it's a tremendous relief today. So now she still didn't go to school today, in part because yesterday, of course, the comparisons that were made between getting the treatment and not included the idea that I wouldn't be around at all if I didn't. And so that brought it home pretty clearly to her. So, but I'm delighted. And as with most things, I see silver lining. And so I got to meet Elizabeth. I've got a new lawyer, so I'm going to hire her for all my business affairs. Abundant, you know, the great. So anyway, thank you.
Elizabeth, can you talk about the legal implications of this decision?
The legal implications are just simply that the external agent that's on contract with the State Department of Health found, as we always argued, that the whole standard of care that Cigna was using was wildly inappropriate. It's not whether or not it's experimental. That's not the standard under New York state law. The standard is whether this treatment would be significantly better than any other treatment for him. And it's true that it would. And since it's substantially more beneficial, Tom won. 2 out of 3. So that was great. And we're really thrilled. And everybody's very happy here at Legal Aid. And it's just a great day, even if it's raining.
And that was Elizabeth Benjamin, who is the supervising health attorney at Legal Aid, and her client and colleague, Tom Kincannon. Quite a victory. Takes a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just in one case, the amount of pressure that had to be brought to bear. But when we think of all of the millions of Americans who are not even in the position that Tom was to at least have some kind of health insurance, you realize that the crisis continues in this country over adequate protection for those who fall ill or have medical problems.
That's right, which is why we have Steffi Wohlhandler on the line. Professor Wohlhandler is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. You just heard the story of Tom Kincannon. Your thoughts?
Well, Mr. Kincannon was lucky that he was a lawyer, that he was healthy enough to actually fight with his HMO. Profit-driven HMOs like Cigna routinely deny expensive care to patients who need it. There's extensive evidence in the literature that people get sick, the care that they need is denied to them by Cigna, denied to them by their for-profit HMOs, and many of them are unable to appeal those decisions and just go without the care that they need. I think it underlines the problem with turning over healthcare to profit-driven HMOs and profit-driven insurance companies like Cigna, and it's just one more argument of why we need nonprofit national health insurance.
Well, Professor, I'd like to ask you, it's been almost 10 years now since the huge battle that occurred in the early parts of the Clinton administration over some kind of national health insurance plan. How would you characterize what the situation has occurred, how the situation has developed since that time for most Americans?
Well, during the decade of the 90s, there was not a whole lot of discussion of national health insurance, and there was a belief in the policy community that somehow managed care was going to solve the problems of the healthcare system. I may not have believed that, but many people did. I think now in 2002, it's clear that HMOs are not going to solve our healthcare problems. Not only do we have millions of instances like Mr. Concannon's where people are denied the care that they need, but we also have a situation in which healthcare costs are expected to go up by as much as 25% next year. And when healthcare costs go up, more people lose their insurance, the business community becomes unhappy, begins to cut back further on care. So we're re-entering a period of crisis as costs go up, and it's pretty evident that HMOs are not going to solve our healthcare problems. So I do think we're going to see a reemergence of debate about healthcare reform over the next 12 to 24 months, and that in that debate we need to think very seriously about eliminating the for-profit insurance industry like Cigna. I mean, just to tell you a little more about Cigna, in one recent year, they took 33% of the premium dollars for profit and overhead, and they were like the market leader. They were publishing in the Wall Street Journal and the business section of the New York Times, oh, aren't we so great? We've got 33% overhead. But for patients like Mr. Kincannon, that means that only 67 cents of every premium dollar was actually available for doctors and nurses and bone marrow transplants because Cigna had taken so much for their overhead and profit. So that's what the for-profit insurance industry is doing. It's squeezing the care of patients, denying patients care in order to make that big overhead and profit. And I think they really have no role in a national health insurance plan.
In just doing a little research on Cigna, we see that there are a number of lawsuits around Cigna. Tennessee's largest physicians organization announced yesterday it's going to sue Tennessee's four biggest health insurers who insure nearly 2.5 million people. The Tennessee Medical Association says Aetna, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Cigna Health Care and United Healthcare threaten patients' health by trying to lower reimbursements and deny higher reimbursements for complicated medical cases. Physicians groups in New York and South Carolina have filed similar lawsuits this year.
Yes. Well, I'm personally much more concerned about the fact that Cigna and similar companies deny care to the patients. They denied bone marrow transplants like Mr. Concannon's, but they also routinely deny the people who have a stroke, for instance, the rehabilitation care that they need. They routinely make it difficult for people who need a mental health hospitalization to get that hospitalization to help get them well. And that's very well established, you know, through very careful studies that these for-profit HMOs make their profits by denying care to patients. And that's why I think they have no role in a national health insurance system.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Professor Stephanie Wohlhandler is professor at Harvard University Medical School. Again, the latest news for those people who heard the program on Wednesday, the attorney Tom Concannon of Legal Aid has, because of an appeal, gotten Cigna's decision reversed, and he will be going back to Boston to complete the procedure of a bone marrow transplant. And I dare say it's probably because of a lot of Democracy Now! Listeners, hundreds of calls that went to Cigna and around the country. And I know that there was local news coverage also on him this week as a result of his appearance here. So good luck, Tom, on your operation. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Venezuela. How did the money of the U.S. government end up in the coffers of the attempted coup leaders in Venezuela? Stay with us.
I see skies of blue, clouds of white, a bright blessed day, a dark sacred night, and I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
Also on the faces of people passing by.
I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? What they are really saying is, I love you. I hear babies cry. Watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know.
You are listening to Democracy Now! What a Wonderful World, Victoria Williams and Vic Chestnut, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk now about Venezuela, and the New York Times is reporting that Washington was even more deeply involved in Venezuela's recent coup than originally acknowledged. In the past year, the United States channeled hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants to American and Venezuelan groups opposed to President Hugo Chavez. One of these was the labor group that organized the protests against Chavez earlier this month. The protests fed directly into the coup. The money for these groups came from the National Endowment for Democracy, a nonprofit agency created and financed by Congress. In the months before the coup, the NED bumped up its funding, quadrupling its donations to Venezuela to nearly $900,000. This money was distributed through four smaller nonprofits, each with its own distinctive role in the dirty wars of the 1980s. One of these groups is the American Center for International Labor Solidarity, the international arm of the AFL-CIO. For decades, an earlier incarnation of the international arm of the AFL-CIO worked closely with the CIA to spread instability through Latin America. It was known until recently as the American Institute of Free Labor and Democracy, AFLD. Now under a new name, it's passed more than $150,000 to Venezuela's main labor union, the same union that led the work stoppages and spurred the opposition to Chavez. The union's leader worked closely with coup president Pedro Carmona to undermine the Chavez government in the months before his ouster. And of course, Carmona took power for a day before Hugo Chavez regained the presidency. Well, today on Democracy Now, we're going to follow that money trail that leads from the coffers of Congress to the hands of coup leaders. And we're going to start by looking at the National Endowment for Democracy with Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us.
Yeah. Incidentally, I'm sorry that I didn't have like 3 days more, because we have a vast holding of material on the National Endowment, which I always consider to be a key Cold War instrumentality. And unfortunately, these papers are scattered all over this office, and we started looking for them this morning, and I just realized it would take days to find them.
Well,
but for another day.
Well, Larry,
Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. They became very prominent during the Central American wars, didn't they, in terms of their role of... could you talk a little bit about how the organization developed?
I'd be glad to. This organization was born in the early years of the Cold War. It was specifically conceptualized by Reagan operatives to be a backdoor funding mechanism for foreign policy issues that would be illegal for U.S. government instrumentalities to engage in, or potentially embarrassing. And this agency was meant to do surgical injections of relatively small amounts of money into projects that had to be done in terms of the ideological checklist of the administration, but couldn't be done through the traditional ways. And they developed a kind of unique methodology. First of all, they recruited as its president probably the most right-wing, hysterical right-wing individual in this country, Carl Gershman, who was Gene Kirkpatrick's assistant at the United Nations, famous for his diatribes. In fact, he was the sort of man who made Gene Kirkpatrick look like a moderate. Well, he comes in as the president of this organization. This organization is nominally a private organization, yet of the average of, let's say, $30 million a year budget, annual budget that it had, it raised characteristically no more than $300,000 or $400,000 through private means, with the rest of the money coming from a vote of Congress. And it got congressional assent rather easily by the clever technique of absorbing, that is, carefully analyzing its enemies in Congress, and then going to them and incorporating in the methodology of the endowment the pet program, the favored approach of that particular congressman. So they systematically denatured opposition to the endowment by co-opting and preempting them.
So let's talk about the National Endowment, the National Endowment for Democracy, the National Democratic Institute, and the International Republican Institute, all that clearly played a key role here in Venezuela and have done it in other situations, as Haiti and in other places.
Right. That, of course, was the strategy. So what you do is you basically set up four funding agencies. Initially, they were the Democratic International Institute, which has a history of doing, I think, probably credible work. You have the International Republican Institute, which, unlike its Democratic counterpart, was deeply ideological and operational, and essentially was the underground methodology for the administration to fund unpopular causes. Like, for example, one of its major projects was to fund the opposition to President Aristide in Haiti. And in fact, the head of the office of the International Republican Institute is a Haitian, related to one of the key opposition figures in Haiti. So he was being funded. Then you had the American Institute of Free Labor Development, the one that you referred to before, And then you had the International Chamber of Commerce. So it was meant to be a balance, business and labor, Republicans and Democrats. But as it panned out, 75% at least of the money was going to extreme right-wing causes.
Well, in the case of Venezuela, for example, the history of the AFL-CIO's international arm, previously called AFIL, now called the American Center for International Labor Solidarity. And I thought when Sweeney came into power, John Sweeney, as head of the AFL-CIO, they'd really cleaned out that what was known as often just working as a front for the CIA in
right.
places like Guyana.
Of course, there was the problem that Sweeney faced. Of, I'm not sure of their budget, but their $8 or $9 million that they would be walking away from if, when they closed down the American Institute of Free Labor Development, they simply closed shop. It was just too much money to close your eyes to. And remember that during this entire period, AFIELD, which you quite correctly characterized as a CIA conduit, for decades, it was really an asset of the agency. It was very strange that under Presidents Lane Kirkpatrick and George Meany of the AFL-CIO, characteristically, the union supported by the American Institute were primarily unions that were ideologically arrayed with the extreme right in the United States, and had very little to do with the trade union movement. And so isn't it strange that in Venezuela, the president of the CTV, Carlos Ortega, is now sort of the co-director of a campaign headed by Pedro Carmona, who was head of Venezuela's largest business group, and together they essentially plotted the coup. Now, you can well imagine.
Except that there was a problem at the end of the coup, apparently, that Carmona neglected to include Ortega or any of the labor leaders in his in the decision making of the choice of the new government, so that they ended up rupturing to some degree. Because I think one of the things that's not clearly understood is that a lot of the opposition to Chavez was not necessarily from the right. There's also opposition to Chavez from the left, and in terms of the Venezuelan union, as I understand it, Ortega is like the highest paid labor leader in all of Venezuela. He does because of, clearly the Petroleum Workers Union is the cream of the crop in terms of paid workers in all of Venezuelan society. So they weren't really necessarily representative of
right.
the entire working class in Venezuela.
You're absolutely correct. Incidentally, you know that strike began. It wasn't really a strike at all. It began as a midweek work stoppage by the senior managers of the state-owned oil company. These people earned on average between $50,000 and $125,000 a year. And mind you, we're talking about a country where 80% of the population live below the poverty line. It is one of the highest figures, perhaps only exceeded by Honduras and Haiti, as the largest percentage of the population living under those straitened circumstances. Also, this work stoppage, which in midweek involved only a handful of people, all of a sudden it became a massive movement. Now, part of the explanation for that is the role played by both the Cuban-American mafia abroad and in the United States. That is, in the State Department and the other agencies of the U.S. government, of the 12 senior Latin American policymaking positions, 7 of them are held by Cuban Americans. Now, there are about 1 million Cuban Americans in this country. There are about 19 million Mexican Americans in the country. There isn't one senior position in the Inter-American Bureau that's held by Mexican-American.
Which brings us to, for example, Otto Reich. And then, I mean, the triumvirate, but the triumvirate at this point that we see the blueprints from before and now the fingerprints on this, what? Elliot Abrams, Otto Reich, John Negroponte.
And Rogelio Pardo Maura.
Exactly. And I'm very glad you mentioned that name, because Pardo Maura in the Pentagon was a key player in making up this policy, as was, of course, the Cuban-American Gustavo Cisneros, who owns one of the largest TV stations in Caracas. That TV station was a prime vehicle for mobilizing the opposition to march downtown and convert that strike, that work stoppage, into a complot to bring down the government.
And what is not known very much in this country is that the Cisneros group there in Venezuela is the largest shareholder in the domestic U.S. Spanish language station, Univision. They actually are the controlling group within Univision. And that's which explains why to this day, for those of you who don't watch Spanish language news, every day on Spanish language news, Venezuela is a main topic, and all of it geared in terms of anti-Chavez coverage here in the United States. So the Latino community in the United States is getting a very, very distorted picture of the Venezuela situation on a daily basis.
Isn't Cisneros a close friend of Bush Sr.?
Yes,
fishing buddy.
Yes, they fish together a lot, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us as we continue to follow developments in Venezuela and really try to look at what was behind the attempted coup that is not getting a tremendous amount of attention. We have touched on in the past the role, we talked about the role of the press in Venezuela. What about here in the New York Times an editorial endorsement of it the weekend that Hugo Chavez was pushed out for a day and then having to sort of backtrack on that in the days that followed. Well, thanks very much, Larry Burns. Joining us from the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C. As we turn to another international issue that is very interesting over the last few months, and that is the number of senior U.N. chiefs who've been basically ousted from their agencies because of pressure from the United States. There's a piece in the Christian Science Monitor on Wednesday about José Bustani, who is the head of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare, OPCW, who was just forced out. And the question is, what role did his working with Iraq have to do with that, trying to bring them into the organization? We're joined by Ian Williams. He's the author of UN for Beginners. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ian.
Hi. There's a very shortened version of this going to be in The Nation in the next issue as well. I should put that in since I am The Nation's UN correspondent. Plugs are welcome. There's a pattern here. Mary Robinson went at the beginning of the year because of American pressure.
That's Mary Robinson, the head.
High Commissioner for Human Rights. The next one, almost unnoticed, last Friday, the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Control, who was not favored by the Texas oil companies, was ousted in a similar coup by the Americans. I think it was in Geneva last Friday. And then on Monday, as you saw, Bustani was ousted. Bustani, the official accusations against him were of managerial incompetence and financial mismanagement and ill-advised initiatives, which was trying to get Iraq to join the Chemical Weapons Convention. None of these complaints had surfaced before last January. He was unanimously re-elected for a new five-year term last year, with letters of plaudit from Colin Powell. And then suddenly, the maker and mover in this seems to be John Bolton, the Undersecretary General for Disarmament Affairs, the Undersecretary of State for Disarmament Affairs in the U.S. government. And making John Bolton head of Disarmament Affairs is a bit like putting a pyrotechnic with a box of matches in a fireworks factory. This guy does not believe in disarmament. This guy loves Star Wars. He likes Big Bangs as long as the U.S. has them and nobody else does. So he's been proceeding accordingly. First, in January, they asked the Brazilians to sack Bustani. The Brazilians pointed out that Bustani is actually elected, an international elected official. He's not a Brazilian government appointee. Then they called an executive council meeting to try to sack him. They said no. Then they called on Bustani and said, we'll let you go quietly if you resign. He said no. So then they did a full court press. They went across the world, and countries that most people have never heard of, like Nauru, which is 5,000 people on an island of bird excreta in the middle of the Pacific, suddenly turned up as full voting delegates wanting to join in the fray. The real thing was the Americans basically said, we'll run away with the ball. We will destroy this operation unless you go along with us in getting rid of Bastani. And this is a very popular convention. It's chemical weapons are poor man's nukes. Anyone can make them in their kitchen. So it needs a lot of inspection. And the other aspect that the Americans didn't like was that Bastani seemed to think that the rules for inspection should apply to the U.S., as the convention says.
Well, and why would the U.S. want him out if he's trying to get Iraq into supervision under the chemical weapons treaty?
Well, nobody's saying this explicitly, but the reasoning seems to be wafting down from Washington that they would consider this. His inspectors would go in. They would give Iraq maybe a clean bill of health, and then the excuse for
the next war
for dropping bombs on Baghdad because Saddam Hussein isn't cooperating with the other inspectors. But this tale gets worse because, of course, the head of the UN's inspectors, this is Unmovic, and it's Hans Blix, the former head of the Atomic Energy Agency. I think you saw recently that the CIA were asked to investigate him to make sure that he was sufficiently pliable and fervent to find what they wanted to find if they ever get into Iraq.
Explain who he is.
Hans Blix used to be the head of the Atomic Energy Agency. And if you remember, when there was the kerfuffle and UNSCOM was sort of pretty much dissolved in the face of accusations of American spying, etc., they were replaced with Hans Blix, who's regarded as a very solid, dependable figure. And he's got a team of inspectors that have been sitting around for a year now, waiting to go into Iraq when Saddam Hussein gives the say-so. So when this administration came in, we're talking about some serious kooky paranoia here. They decided they wanted to check his credentials out.
What about Mary Robinson? We haven't talked a lot about that. Very outspoken on the issue of human rights. What about the role of the U.S. in... It's not exactly ouster, but ending her term, so she can't. She won't be able to.
Yeah, she was not renewed, but there was a huge amount of backdoor lobbying by the U.S. And the key issue seems to have been, as always, the Middle East. She's been very outspoken on affairs in the occupied territories, but also when the U.S. and Israel withdrew from the International Racism Conference in Durban last year, she carried on along with the rest of the countries in the world and applauded the final result. Now, you know, sort of 187 votes to two is... this is democracy now. The two votes always win. So she has been proved to be uncooperative. And they put a lot of backdoor pressure. I think it's interesting because all of these things are done undercover. If you went to the normal public and said, the scientist in charge of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Control, who's established that global warming is caused by emissions from oil companies and coal, is sacked... people might get concerned. So you do it quietly. If you go and say, Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, imagine in a country with allegedly 40 million Irish-American voters, we're sacking the president of Ireland because we don't like what she says. That was never said anywhere. All done behind doors. And I think it's where democracy is really missing in foreign policy here. Not enough people are watching.
What's been the impact of the Bush administration at the United Nations, especially now with Negroponte, who I wouldn't consider a man of peace, certainly not in terms of his record, but has there been any significant change in the way that the Bush administration has been functioning at the UN?
Actually, because Colin Powell is the Secretary of State, we're on a sort of two-track operation here. Colin Powell is, as far as we know, in constant and friendly contact with Colin Powell and with other diplomats across the world. So Negroponte officially reports to him. So on that level, things are actually going quite well. Obviously, when key issues come in, like the Middle East, then you have the vetoes and the jumping up and down. And I think it's been very interesting recently that there's been a change that instead of washing their hands and doing a Jesse Helms on the United Nations, a more sophisticated form of isolationism is taking place where you make the international organizations do what you want them to. And part of that change has been the fact that after two decades, we've suddenly got four Security Council resolutions on the Middle East issue, when for decades the US has always said this should not come before the Security Council. It should be negotiated between Israel and Palestine. So we've had the US sponsoring the last resolution on the fact-finding mission. We had the US sponsoring the resolution saying that Israel should get out. And there's a recognition there, but they may have fallen into a trap because, of course, it holds up their behavior for comparison. And when get out without delay means at your convenience when you've finished firing. The rest of the world notices this. And when you say, we want a fact-finding mission in, and the Israelis say, well, yes, we want, welcome a fact-finding mission, as long as it's a fact-finding mission that's going to find the facts that we want them to find with the people we want to find them. So the U.S. is sort of making a stick for its own back at the moment, in, diplomatically.
Well, Ian Williams, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ian Williams is the author of UN for Beginners and reports on the United Nations for The Nation magazine. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to France to find out about the surprise second-place finish of the ultra-rightist Jean-Marie Le Pen. What does it all mean? Stay with us.
You got a lot of societies and governments trying to be God, wishing that they were God. They want to create satellites and cameras everywhere, make you think they got the all-seeing eye. I guess the last force was too far off when they said that certain people got a God complex. I believe it's true. I don't get phased out by none of that. None of the helicopters, the TV screens, the newscasters, the satellite dishes. They just wishing. They can't never really do that. When they tell me to fear they law, when they tell me to try to have some fret in my heart behind the things that they do, this is what I think in my mind. And this is what I say to them, and this is what I'm saying to you, check it. All over the world, hearts pound with the rhythm. Fear not of men because men must die. Mind over matter and soul before flesh. Angels hold the pain, keep a record in time.
Fear not of man, Mostaf, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. French universities closed their doors on Thursday, declared a day without classes as more than 100,000 students marched through the streets to show their opposition to ultra-nationalist Jean-Marie Le Pen. Le Pen surprised the nation last Sunday by coming in second with the first round of presidential elections, booting current President Lionel Jospin from the running. Le Pen says if elected, he'll move to cut France's ties with the European Union, halt the flow of immigrants, phase out income tax. He opposes abortion, supports the death penalty. He's been accused of being anti-Semitic. His victory has sent tens of thousands of protesters into the streets of France each day. It's also sent Europe reeling. The wave of anti-Le Pen protests spilled into Belgium Wednesday as Le Pen arrived to deliver an address before the European Union. Inside, people booed during his speech and waved signs saying no. Outside, activists wore Stop the Nazi stickers and held banners reading Together Against Hatred.
The rise of Jean-Marie Le Pen has tapped into fears that a new fascism is taking hold in Europe. Already, extremist parties have scored upsets in Austria, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Italy, and Belgium. Meanwhile, a wave of anti-Jewish violence has ripped through France. More than 300 anti-Semitic incidents have been reported in the last 3 weeks. Increases in attacks have also been reported in Britain, Russia, and Belgium.
We're going to go to France as well as right here in the United States to Martin Lee, author of The Beast Reawakens on the Rise of Fascism. Lee has written for The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle. In France, we're joined by Theo Klein, honorary president of the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions. Let's get a first comment from you, Theo Klein, on the significance of the Le Pen second place finish, though he's not expected to win in May in running off against the French President Jacques Chirac.
Yes. In my opinion, it's more the defeat of Mr. Le Pen than the success of Le Pen. But it's true that to have Le Pen with 20% of the vote is very important and very dangerous. But what is going on now on the street in France with the young people of France is, in my opinion, much more important than the success of Mr. Le Pen on the first vote. What is going on here is to know what will be the results after the second tour. And if Mr. Le Pen will have more than, let's say, 30% of the vote, it can be dangerous. If not, I think we will overcome this period, this shock, what is important, but it's also important to have the reaction on the shock. I don't think that we are in a very big danger of fascism. in France, but it's true that we have in Europe, we have Berlusconi in Italy, who is not a fascist, but can be a fascist. And you have also the situation in Austria. So it's true that we have in Europe a tendency to the right wing after the tendency to the left wing. But it's, I think, in the history of Europe, you have always had these kind of things without going until the fascist movement.
Well, we'd like to bring in Martin Lee into the conversation as well. Martin Lee, how do you see this growing right-wing trend in Europe? Do you agree that it's a part of just of the cyclical changes in political directions and the continent?
You know, I wish it were just sort of a pendulum swinging back and forth, but I think in terms of these extreme right-wing parties, the radical right-wing populist parties such as Le Pen's Front National, which in the case of France is a party with openly fascist roots, this is something that's been building for some time. Le Pen had his first electoral breakthrough 20 years ago, and it's been a pretty steady rise since then. And Le Pen's party has really served as the prototype for similar parties throughout Western Europe that have been making significant gains. What we see now is coalitions taking place in Austria and Italy. It's governing coalitions involving extreme right parties. In other countries such as Portugal and Denmark, we see extreme right parties supporting a right-of-center government. So I think what we could very well be in the midst of is kind of a sea change in European politics, where the debate has been redefined by these neo-fascist parties. George Masi, he's a late scholar on the Third Reich, he said one of the Nazi Party's principal victories before it seized power in the 1930s was that it forced centrists and leftists to argue on terrain occupied by the racist right. And I think, to a large degree, Le Pen has already achieved that victory. I'm not suggesting we're about to see a Fourth Reich or something like that, but this is a very serious change that is taking place in Europe right now.
Is it really significant when you look at the number of parties on the left there were in France that divided the vote? If you look actually at what Le Pen won, well, it's still significant in the range of, what, 15%. But he clearly, would say he has no chance against Jacques Chirac? Martin Lee?
Yes, I think you've made a good point, Amy, in that if you compare Le Pen's vote, his recent breakthrough, the amount of votes he got, to the 1995 vote when he ran for president, he only got about a quarter of a million more votes, which in a country the size of France isn't necessarily that significant in and of itself, but it's the background or the backdrop against the vote which is so significant, and the fact that so many people chose not to vote. What we're really seeing in some sense is the collapse of the center, not just in France, but throughout Western Europe. And I think that's for many reasons that's happening, not the least of which has to do is a perception of the left, if you can call the Socialist Party a left-wing party, really had betrayed its base, that it acted almost as a running boy for implementing the policies of the European Union, which were policies almost like structural adjustments, something comparable to that in the Third World, policies that would be seen as socially regressive. And this was a period of what's called cohabitation, when a socialist president in France governed with a conservative prime minister. And a lot of people saw it as kind of Tweedledee, Tweedledum. You know, where's the alternative here? And if you're looking for an alternative, you weren't either likely to vote for either of the two main center parties. So a lot of people ended up registering a protest vote for Le Pen.
And I'd like to ask Theo Klein, in terms of the rise of these neo-fascist or right-wing movements in France, and at the same time the rise of anti-Semitic attacks, what the relationship is between the two, are the anti-Semitic attacks more reflection of what's going on in the Middle East, or is it part of the long history of anti-Semitism within Europe itself?
What you are calling anti-Semitism is related only to what is going on between Palestinian and Israeli. It's going on here between Jews and Arabs. In my opinion, it has nothing to do with the rise of Mr. Le Pen, and Mr. Le Pen has no words about this kind of situation. It's true that Mr. Le Pen itself is an anti-Semite. It's true that his movement is a movement in which you have many anti-Semitic people. But it is not an anti-Semitic movement as a movement. It is a movement with anti-Semitic people. And he has nothing to do with what was going on here. It's always going on between young people and Jewish targets.
Let me ask you, Theo Klein, on the issue of what his popularity, to what extent it is in France right now. You've got the post September 11th attacks on Arabs. You've got his approach. You've got him being extremely anti-immigrant and anti-Semitic, including anti-Jewish and anti-Arab. What about the relationship between Jews and Arabs in France?
If you speak generally, I think that the relations are positive. I am sitting in my office near a colleague who is from Algeria. And, you know, we have no general problems with the Arabic or Muslim population here in France. But when you have such kind of period as now between Israeli and Palestinian, you have part of the two populations which to give an expression to their solidarity. And in the quarter, in the suburbs, or in such part of the of some towns, which you, if you have a very big Jewish population and Arabic population, you have such kind of thing, what you learn about what was going on in France. It's a kind of anti-Semitism, but a very special kind because it is between two people that are, the two are Semitic people.
What do you think is the answer, Theo Klein? What's the solution here?
Here in France, we have no solution of this problem. We have a problem with the violence of this kind of people, and that is a question for the French government. And the French government has many problems to find a solution. It's very hard to find a solution because the people who make this is a very young people, and it's very hard to have a good solution for people from who are 12, 13, 14, and not more.
What about in the Middle East?
What about the Middle East? The solution is in the Middle East and not in France. We have no possibility to say to Mr. Sharon or to Mr. Arafat what they have to do. We can only hope that they will do positive things, but it's a wish. It's not more than a wish.
Matthew Martin Lee, your final comments.
It's often been said about Le Pen's breakthrough that this is a threat to democracy in France and in Europe. I see it less as a threat to democracy than as a reflection or a manifestation of a weakness of democracy. And I think it's a frustration people feel with unchecked corporate power and globalization that they have less control over their lives, so that when someone comes spouting ultra-nationalist rhetoric, people fall for it, and that's very unfortunate, but I think it's a phenomenon. Factors are likely to keep this continuing for some time.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Martin Lee is author of The Beast Reawakens. Theo Klein is honorary president of the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions in France. And that does it for today's program. I'm looking forward to seeing listeners of KOPN in Columbia, Missouri at Fisher Hall at the University of Missouri Journalism School, where you went one a while ago. Democracy Now! Is produced by Miranda Kennedy, Chris Abrams, Lizzie Ratner, Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!